Great, thanks. This is actually my last day here. So, you know, probably if you find anything about this interesting, we should follow up about it afterwards by email or whatever. This is a theory talk. I'm not going to show any data. I'm not going to try and fit any data. It's kind of a conceptual talk. The general game plan is to try and come up with a fairly simple, tractable theoretical framework that has the potential to explain a lot of different kinds of phenomenology in different neural systems and with different behaviors. And it includes all of these things, oscillations, recurrence, gated, and neural integrators. The important thing, though, was to make the acronym organics. And for those of you who don't catch the relevance of that, I urge you, you can pull out your phone right now, do a Google search for my last name, Heger, organics, and scroll down a bit, okay? And then you'll find there's a certain connection between the name Heger and the word organics that you can learn about. Everything that I'm going to talk about today is published. A little bit of it is in this PNAS paper from 2017, and most of the slides are figures from this paper that's on archive with a postdoc, Wayne Mackey, that we posted last spring. There's a lot more that we've done since then, which I can tell you about, as I'm sure it'll come up in questions. Okay? All right. So to get started, I'm going to talk a little bit about working memory and use that as kind of a way of getting a foot in the door to talk about this this theory framework. And so I'm going to talk about remind you about working memory from three different perspectives. First from a perspective of psychology, which is where the word comes from, then from an AI perspective, and then from a neuroscience perspective, and then from an AI perspective. So in cognitive psychology, working memory is a process that's responsible for both maintaining and manipulating information. So a simple example of that that we can draw from language, I'm not really talking about language, but this is a nice example of working memory, is this sentence here: the athlete realizes goals which were formed during childhood to qualify this year's Olympic team. And then you can finish it either of two ways. Either quickly, realized his goals quickly, or realized his goals were unattainable. So at the end of the sentence, the way that it completes disambiguates the meaning of the beginning of the sentence. Okay? So, you know, a simple-minded way, and this is called the problem of long-term dependencies in psychology and AI, a simple-minded way that you could go about trying to deal with this would be to have a really long buffer so that you store all the information about the sentence up until that last bit at the end, and then you can resolve it when you've got that. But of course, in language, because it's compositional, you know, that there are these couple phrases, which were formed during childhood, to qualify. We could keep adding more phrases in there, right? And you'd need to have, in principle, an infinitely long buffer, okay? So that's not how we think the problem is solved. Yeah?
But if you just say the athlete realized his goal, there is already a working memory.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it would be just a bunch of words.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So why did you go through?
Because I'm trying to illustrate the problem of the really long-term dependencies, that you need to store some information online. That's the idea. Okay, that you're holding information online, and that at some point later, you manipulate that information that you're holding. Okay, so that makes it distinctly different from what psychologists call short-term memory. The term short-term memory is used to refer to just holding information online without having to manipulate it. And the term working memory means that you're both maintaining and manipulating. Okay? All right. So in neuroscience, working memory has become synonymous with short-term memory, unfortunately. And the way that people have studied working memory is typically with delayed response tasks, like a memory-guided saccade task. So here's an illustration of one of those. I think many of you know how this works. You're holding fixation. A target is flashed, but you're not allowed to look at it yet. You have to remain holding fixation in the middle of the screen. A while later, the fixation point goes away. The target, which was flashed, is now long gone, but you have to make an eye movement to the remembered location at which the target was flashed. In some experiments, the target reappears so you can get reinforcement and a correction, and then the fixation point reappears. You make an eye moving back to the middle of the screen to start the next trial. And when you do this in monkeys and record from a bunch of different brain areas, or in humans and look at a bunch of different brain areas, you see that there's sustained activity during the delay period, this period of time, after the target was flashed, before the eye movement was made, that we think of as the neural representation of this information that's being stored over time. Okay? And again, that this is really short-term memory. It's not really working memory because there's no manipulation, something that I'll come back to in a minute. So there's lots of data on this. There are models of this. This happens to be, you know, from X.J. Wang's work with various colleagues. Pat Goldman-Rakich, of course, is one of the people who did a bunch of the important measurements of this delay period activity in prefrontal cortex. So in this particular model, you have neurons, presumably prefrontal neurons, frontal eye field neurons, each of which responds selectively to a different location in a ring around the center of the visual field. And each of them is kind of selective for a particular location. And the idea is that, you know, if the target is flashed up here, then those neurons, these guys up here, respond strongly, and their responses stay on during the delay period after the target has disappeared. So this is those different neurons laid out along the vertical axis here. This is time running that way. This is when the target is flashed. There's this bump of activity that persists during the delay period, and then the cue is made. Is presented that cues the animal or person to make the eye movement, and then the response gets shut down. Okay, so there's that bump in activity that persists through the delay period.
This is model.
This is model simulation. Okay, that looks kind of like data in some ways. Okay, all right. So what are the but there are a couple big problems, I think, with this whole paradigm and thinking about working memory. And one of them I already alluded to, which is that working memory really involves manipulation as well as maintenance, not just maintenance. So the whole story about sustained delay period activity being the neural correlate of working memory is missing something important, which is that for it to really be working memory, you have to be working on it. So it shouldn't be sustained. It should actually be changing. It should be changing in particular interesting ways. Okay? For example, right. So, for example, in a double-step saccade, if you inserted delay periods, and I'll even come to this as an example. So let's do a variation on this experiment. Instead of flashing just one target.
Standard experiment where you have delay to match. You mentioned.
Yeah. Okay.
Delay to match. So when you have a match, you have some kind of manipulation.
Well, not necessarily manipulation. It could just be matching the readout of the activity at the end of the delay, right? But we can try to think of other tasks that actually do involve manipulation, right? And I'll show you an example of one, so I'll hold off on that. A double-step saccade is a nice, simple example.
Yeah. Very elementary, naive question. So if naively I'll associate this bump of activity with my memory of
some
stimulus, when you give me the cue and I make a decision, this bump disappears.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, too.
In the experiment, I would still remember.
Right.
So that interpretation was not correct.
Okay. So there's a bunch of issues that are coming up here, right? One of them is, you know, how do you gate the representation on? How do you gate it off? How do you read it out? Okay? How do you manipulate it? You know, all of this, okay? So, I mean, I think I want to try to provide a richer theoretical framework for thinking about all of these bits and pieces, and we're going to unfold one step at a time, okay? All right. So the other problem with this is that measurements of neural activity sometimes look kind of like the story, the sustained delay period activity, as illustrated here. But even here, it's not like it's constant over time. It goes up, and then it comes down, and you know. And in other measurements, there's lots of dynamics during the delay period. Lots. Okay. That just seems to be just a fundamentally big problem. Let's imagine a version of this experiment in which you didn't know, which you can easily do. You can train people and animals, monkeys, easily to do a task in which the delay period duration from one trial to the next is unknown. So it's randomized from trial to trial. That means you have to be ready to do the readout at any point in time. during the delay period, because you don't know how long it's going to be. And if the activity isn't a constant bump, but is kind of going up and down or whatever, then how the hell do you do the readout? The cue comes to do the readout, and it's the representation seems to have changed out from under you. Okay?
Depends on whether you read out the same, like all of the directions, or maybe some directions are constant.
Okay, so there are ways that you might solve it. I'm gonna give you one way of thinking about it. Okay? All right, and I want that to make sense with respect to this. That, you know, in general, working memory is about manipulating and maintaining. So you want to be able to manipulate and maintain and read out, okay? And think about it in that more general way. Okay? So here's an example. I promise no data, but that, so that this, you know, I'm just going to show you an example of the degree to which these delay period activity can be different from sustained delay period activity. This happens to be from a recent paper from Mike Colossus' lab. Mike used to be at NYU, just moved to MIT. And this happens to be in a mouse doing a different task. It doesn't really matter. But what you see here is each of these curves corresponds to the firing rate of a different neuron. And you see this pattern in which one neuron becomes active, and then it seems to trigger activity in the next neuron, which triggers activity in the next neuron. And there's like this handoff from one to the next, which has been called by some people sequential activity, by others, synfire chain. Moshe Abeles, in particular, to popularize this notion of a synfire chain. So that's an extreme example of something that's quite different from sustained delay period activity. Okay. So, you know, so part of what I want to do here is come up with a computational motif that's capable of doing manipulation in addition to maintenance, and that can do all of that in a way that sometimes it looks like sustained delay period activity, and other times it looks like, you know, changing dynamics, and other times it even looks like a synfire chain, looks like this sequential activity, okay, all within the same framework. Now, this came up yesterday. There's a device out of the AI machine learning literature called an LSTM, which is a stupid name. It stands for long short-term memory. There are two things that are stupid about the name. One is that it's an oxymoron, long short. The other one is that it's not really about short-term memory at all, at least as defined by the psychologists. It's really about working memory. It's the AI solution to this problem of long-term dependencies. And the details of it actually don't matter, because I'm going to derive for you from a starting point that's more familiar to all of us, something that ends up being very similar to a particular variety of LSTM that you heard about yesterday from David, if he's here, called a gated recurrent unit, or a GRU. In fact, when I started working on this, I didn't know what an LSTM was. And I kind of reinvented it, and then realized it was very, very similar to the thing that that's been around in the AI literature for 20 years. This guy, Kyung-Yun Cho, is a colleague at NYU, and is the first author on the gated recurrent unit paper, the GRU paper. So, we'll dispense with the details of this, but just point out that there are two key insights here. So the idea of a LSTM, or a gated recurrent unit, is to take a basic, simple, linear recurrent neural network and add to it two what they call gates, or what we could call modulators, that you multiply by respectively the inputs to do gated integration and the output to do a reset. Okay? And you do that separately for each neuron. So we'll walk through this. Okay, but before we do that, I just want to give you a fun example of how powerful these things are. So there's tons of these examples online. This happens to be one from this guy's blog. A lot of the stuff with LSTMs has been used in AI applications in text processing. And in this particular example, he trained up a neural net that has three layers of these GRUs on the complete works of Shakespeare. And what do I mean by train? So you feed in some representation, some embedding of the sequence of ASCII characters one after the next. Okay, and And you use gradient descent, back propagation, to learn the weights and the weight matrices, and I'll lay out what the weight matrices are in a couple minutes, to try to predict what the next ASCII character will be. Okay? And when you're done, you have this machine that does a bunch of weighted sums and a few nonlinearities and then predicts what the next character will be, and then you can feed in the next character and see how close to that prediction you were. Or you could play this funny game of seed it with a character, have it predict the next character, feed that back into the input, and have it predict the next character and generate Shakespeare-like text, and that's what this is. This is fake Shakespeare-like text that's generated from a recurrent neural net based on three layers of gated recurrent units that generates text that looks kind of like Shakespeare. It's meaningless, right? Because remember, the thing was trained on individual ASCII characters one after the next. But it gets a lot of stuff right. I mean, it has the basic structure of it right. There are words, there are spaces, the words are recognizable, even phrases make sense, right? But the overall semantics of the thing is nonsense, right? So these are very powerful. They're actually kind of this is called the unreasonable effectiveness of recurrent low networks. They're kind of ridiculously powerful, in solving problems that have exactly this nature of long-term dependencies. Okay? All right. So I want to introduce the... It was trained on Shakespeare.
It was trained on Shakespeare, so why didn't it converge to the text that it was trained?
Okay, so I mean,
if it was right. The next should be right as well. Right?
Okay, so.
The insert, they do a probability distribution sampling to get the autoregressor generating text. So there's
I mean, I think it is true that if you were to give this thing a large enough number of hidden units, then would basically memorize the complete works of Shakespeare. And you could seed it anywhere and it would generate the rest of the play. Okay? But you're giving it limited capacity. So it's doing the best it can. Okay? All right. So let's just take a step back and talk about a linear recurrent network, a leaky neural integrator. Okay? So this should be, I hope, familiar to most of you with the exception of one. So this is the response of an output neuron, a principal neuron. This is in the form of the membrane equation. Its response changes over time depending on some input and some recurrent drive. Okay? The input Z, I'm calling the input drive, is an embedding of an input X. Okay? So there's like some stimulus coming in X, which is a vector. It gets multiplied by these weights. That gives you the input drive. And then there's a recurrent drive, which is a weighted sum of the responses. Okay? And then there's this state parameter, lambda, here, which is just going to adjust the effective time constant of the whole thing. Right? So this is a linear system. It's a straight-up shift-invariant linear system, acts as a low-pass filter with an exponential impulse response function. Right? Okay. What's that? What does? The W over here.
Yeah.
Right. So we want to make sure that this thing is well behaved, right? So I want the largest eigenvalue of this thing to be no bigger than 1 so that it doesn't explode. And that's something that we'll come back to. Okay? All right. So, so here's a little illustration of one in which X has 2 numbers in it. So the vector X has 2 elements. Y has, what do I have here? 8. Do I have 8? Yeah. So those are the y's coming out, and for a particular set of weights, so this y here is taking a weighted sum of these 2 inputs where the black filled lines mean positive weights and the dashed lines mean negative weights, and then if you look at this one here, it has recurrent feedback from itself and its neighbors and recurrent inhibition from further away, okay? And I'm only showing some of the recurrence here because there would be too many little arrows on the table, okay? Fine. And how does it behave? Well, you give it an input that looks like this, and you get outputs that look like this. The different curves here correspond to different values of the lambda parameter, right? You can do a little bit of algebra and see why that's the case. that you know you just rearrange this equation and rewrite this with a tau prime, and you find that the effective time constant is the intrinsic time constant divided by the lambda parameter, and so you get these exponential rise and exponential decay in which the time constant of the exponential depends on the value of lambda that you give it. Now, if we wanted sustained delay period activity, then we would want, when the input comes on, we'd want lambda to be close to 1 so that the output follows the input and ignores the recurrence. That's this curve, okay? Because you want to latch in the input. But then, before the stimulus goes off, we actually kind of want lambda to be close to 0 so that this thing becomes close to 1 and we're holding the recurrence and ignoring the input. And that's this curve down here, right, which has a long slow decay. Right? So that's the first idea here, is that even just to have sustained delay period activity, you actually want to have a gate or a modulator that takes the role of lambda. So you want to switch the state from one which is input driven to one which is recurrently driven. And that's exactly the input gate in a gated recurrent unit. Okay? That's exactly what it does. Yeah, these curves are for different lambda. Right, so this is for lambda that's close to 1, and this is for lambda that's close to 0. So that the time constant is really slow, but the decay is, the rise is really slow, but the decay is really slow.
Okay.
Well, we haven't switched it yet. We will now. Okay. Yeah, those were each for a different fixed lambda. What I'm trying to give you the intuition is that what you really want to do is you want to switch the lambda, okay, rather than have a fixed lambda. So this is how I'm writing, you know, my variant of an LSTM that I'm calling organics. So now I have a whole vector y sub j for each neuron. I have a whole bunch of principal neurons y. They all, in this version, all have the same time constant that I'm calling tau y. Again, it's in the form of the membrane equation, so that the change in y is equal to minus y, plus something that depends on an input and something that depends on a recurrent drive, right? So the input drive ZJ and the recurrent drive Y hat are the same as what we had before. Z is just a weighted sum of the inputs, plus, if you want, a non-zero bias term. The recurrence is a weighted sum of the outputs, plus, if you want, a non-zero bias term. And now I have I've replaced the lambda with a pair of modulators, okay? One of them I'm writing as B over 1 plus B, and the other one I'm writing as 1 over 1 plus A. If A were equal to B, and it was the same for all the J's, then I could replace this with a lambda and a 1 minus lambda. Okay? Right. But here, I'm going to allow them to be different from one another, and in fact, in principle, different from one another for each of the J's, for each neuron in the population. Okay? And that's the way that it's typically done in AI. My guess is that you probably don't have as many modulators as you have principal neurons, and that there's a smaller subspace of them. But in the example I'm going to show you, I'm actually going to mostly get rid of the subscript J on the A's and B's and just have one global input gate and reset gate modulator. Okay. All right. But where do these come from? So I don't know exactly what story to tell there. I'm now just grabbing this, the equations for A and B, from the way that it's done in a gated recurrent unit, which is that the A and the B are themselves, dynamical systems that are weighted sums of the inputs and the outputs. Okay. The way that it's done in the AI applications is that all of these weight matrices are allowed to be anything. Okay, I think that's part of the problem, difficulty in training them. And there might be something to be gained in AI from thinking about forcing structure into them, analogous to the way that convolutional neural nets, have been so much more successful than kind of generic, fully connected neural nets. One could imagine doing something similar here. But as far as I know, that hasn't really been explored a lot in recurrent neural nets in AI. Okay, so we can think of them as being just general. You can fill them with anything you want. Okay.
What is the purpose of the modulator in AI, for example? What I can do?
Ah, Right, so the intuition is like this, and we'll get to that, right? So think about the memory-guided saccade task. There are cues. There's a cue that tells you the target's about to appear. Okay, let's change the state of the network to be input-driven, because there's about to be an input. And then the target's going to disappear. Let's change the state so that now A and B are both small, so that we're ignoring the input, and 1 over 1 plus something small is close to 1, and being driven by the recurrence. Okay? Then after the end of the trial, you want to forget that. So let's just turn A back on, right? And that squashes the recurrence, and you're ready for the next trial. Okay? Right. So that's a reason why you would want the modulators to depend on the input. Why would you want it to depend on the output? Well, that depends on the form of the manipulation that you want to do, right? So remember, in general, for working memory, it's not just the maintenance of information, but also the manipulation. You might want the form of the manipulation to depend on the current representation in addition to the current input. Okay? All right.
So, in terms of what you just said, is introducing the A and the B allows for forms of manipulation that what you're picking up are altering the weights of the input.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
It's
exactly. This doesn't let you do everything. There's actually, computational there's constraints on the computations that can be done with this, at least with a finite number of neurons. Okay, there's limitations. But you can do a hell of a lot more with this than you can with a simple linear recurrent network or with a feedforward deep net, right? And in fact, I would argue that even just restricting to having a getting rid of the subscript J on the A and the B, you're already capable of solving tasks that are more powerful than any of the ones that we or any of our colleagues use in neuroscience experiments. Okay, it's a reasonably powerful computational motif, but it's simple enough that we can get a handle on it. And in particular, for periods of time when A and B are fixed, it's a linear system, right? So we can have periods of time when A and B are both large, so that it's input-driven, right? And let's say that the encoding matrix here is convolutional. Okay, that's just like receptive fields in V1 or somatosensory system or auditory system. Right? Or we can have periods of time in which A and B are both zero or close to zero. Well, that's a recurrent neural net that's going to sustain activity, right? Or we could do stuff like have that going on, but then leave A close to zero, but then open up the B gate for a little while. But that's going to do integration, not leaky integration, full-on integration, because you're holding the recurrent representation coming from Y hat and integrating in new input. So that's sensory integration, like Shadlin, Newsom, okay? So that's what I mean. Just with this, even if these things are kind of global states, you can do a whole bunch of things with it, okay? But it's basically, for chunks of time when A and B are constant, it's a linear system. So, even I can understand it, right? Okay. I'm not wedded. So in AI, these are written as weighted sums of inputs and outputs. I'm not wedded to that. And in fact, there's a version of this that I'm also working on, I'm not going to tell you about today, has a particular nonlinear function for the recurrence here that does interesting things too. So there's generalizations of this, that are extensions, generalizations that are worthwhile. So I actually have already kind of walked through this, but I'm just laying out for you an example of a kind of simulation of a simplified version of the memory-guided saccade task. This is my recurrent weight matrix. It's convolutional. Okay, so this is positive weights. These are actually small negative weights here. Any one neuron is getting a weighted sum of its neighbors with positive weight here falling off and then negatives on the flanks, just as I illustrated a couple slides ago. I'm using a very simple-minded version of this. So the input is the X and Y coordinate of the target on a screen. To do this correctly, you'd want to do that with a bunch of neurons that have response fields, that are selective for different locations on the screen. I've implemented that too, but I'm not showing you that version because this is simpler. Okay? So this is what you get by multiplying those two inputs, X, through an embedding matrix. So there's eight by eight here. So there's eight principal neurons. So this is going to be an 8x2 matrix, which gives me eight values for this input drive. I will tell you in a moment where I got that 8x2 matrix from. Okay. This is the time courses of my two modulators. I just set them according to the structure of the task, what we were just talking about, right? That at the beginning of the trial, you want to encode the input. Then there's a period of time when you want to hold it. Then at the end of the trial, you want to forget it. So I turn both A and B on so that the responses follow the input drive. And then I switch them both off before the input goes off so that it's sustained. And then I turn A back on again to cause it to forget. Now you had a question.
It looks like here you're just setting your big A and B by hand. But
essentially I am,
right.
Yeah.
But I thought in the previous slide they were also given by linear equations.
That's right. So what did I actually do? What I actually did was I have four inputs, two of which correspond to the target location, and two of which correspond to cues that are presented to the virtual animal during the virtual task, which is the trial's about to begin, the delay period's about to begin, the trial's now over. So those are actual visual stimuli that are processed and can be provided as additional input.
So it's different inputs from your X.
That's correct.
But then A and B are both perfect integrators.
A and B are actually leaky integrators. Okay, but the Q is on. The Q is on, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Just to make contact with biology, but I'm using very simple hand-tuned examples to walk through what the computation is capable of and how we can analyze it. I will write this a little bit later as with a equivalent electric circuit model of a pyramidal cell. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. So this is kind of a conceptual talk. There's pieces of this that I can ground closer to the biology, and there are other pieces of this that, frankly, I want your help with. Okay. So we'll see that. Okay. All right. So this is very simple, and it recapitulates sustained delay period activity, which I've already told you I'm kind of bored with, so we want to move past that. But we want to make sure we understand it, and I think everybody in the room already knows this, that that the stability of the activity during the delay period depends, of course, on the eigenvalues of the recurrent weight matrix, right? It depends on the eigenvalues of this matrix here, okay? In this particular case, this recurrent weight matrix was designed so that two of the eigenvalues are equal to one, and the other ones are less than one, so that it perfectly sustains the activity during the delay period. If the eigenvalues were bigger than one, then it would explode. If the eigenvalues were less than one, then it would decay, and you all know that, okay? All right. The other thing that I can now say is that the encoding matrix and the encoding matrix here and the readout matrix here were both chosen to be the eigenvectors. The two eigenvectors corresponding to those two eigenvalues that are equal to one, because that's exactly the subspace that the input is going to get projected onto during the delay period, and that's exactly the way to read it out at any point during the delay period. Okay? So the intuition for that should make sense. Right? If I were to choose the encoding matrix to be different from that, as soon as the delay period starts, it's going to end up projecting onto those eigenvectors, you know, eventually anyway, because the other six eigenvectors are going to decay away because their eigenvalues are less than one, right? Okay, and I can write, and that's what's This is just, I have this slide in here because I've given this talk to groups of people who don't know what an eigenvector is, but we'll just skip that, okay? So the recurrent weight matrix has two eigenvalues equal to one, the others are less than one, it's a two-dimensional continuous attractor. I'm choosing the encoding weights and the readout weights to be literally the those two eigenvectors corresponding to the eigenvalues that are equal to one. So V is the columns of the columns of V are the eigenvectors that have corresponding eigenvalues equal to one. And then we can easily enough derive that if you use that same pair of eigenvectors for the readout, then the estimate of the target location is equal to the target location that you gave it, okay? And you can work that out for yourself. It's pretty simple, okay? All right. Now, I want to get to dynamics and modulation and oscillations, but first I want to show you an example. Again, an extremely simple hand-tuned ad hoc example of manipulation just to give you the sense for how this kind of computational motif can do it. Okay? So this is a version of the double step saccade task. Yeah. For what in particular? For this idea, for the gates? Yeah.
There are some constraints here.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, I think of it more the other way around. I think there's a whole bunch of phenomena out there that are calling out for an explanation and a need for a broader set of conceptual tools. Okay? So, you know, indirectly I'll show you examples of how this thing can produce, you know, oscillations and dynamics and sequential activity and still have a readout rule. Okay? So, you know, is that evidence for us, not direct test of it? Okay, so I'm going the other way. What I'm trying to do is build an umbrella that can capture a bunch of phenomenology and that is tractable enough that we could actually think through how to design experiments that would test it and refute it. Okay, so that's where I'm coming from, right? But, you know, I'm trying to have it touch on a bunch of different things, right? So the idea here is this relates to the idea of sensory integration. You know, from Mike Shadlin's work, it relates to the idea of different versions of how information can be represented during a delay period. It relates to the psychology of manipulation during working memory. It relates to a number of things that we've talked about over the past couple days, right? This notion of there being a linear subspace in which the neural activity lives, right? So if you look at this thing, back where I have the equation here, right? So when A and B are both big, right? The neural activity lives in that linear subspace, given by the rows of this matrix, the projection functions, the receptive fields. Okay, when A and B are both small, the neural activity lives in the subspace spanned by the eigenvectors of that matrix. Right. So, like in the example I just showed you, that's a two-dimensional subspace. Oh, sorry, of that. I pointed at the wrong thing. Thank you. You didn't understand because I pointed at the wrong thing. Now it makes sense. The eigenvectors of that thing. Well, given that I just told you that this matrix is the same as the eigenvectors of that thing, it was technically correct, but it was misleading. Okay? Of the eigenvectors of that thing that have corresponding eigenvalues equal to one. Right? Because if you leave that state on for a while, the other components are going to decay. Right? So now you can start thinking. So now that's kind of interesting. So there's a notion of there being actual linear subspaces. We can call it a manifold, but it's just a linear subspace, right? But the linear subspace that the neural activity lives in now depends on the state, which is dictated by the values of the modulators, which themselves can change over time, okay? So you can imagine conditions in which you're in one subspace or the other subspace, or if A and B are equal to one another at some intermediate value, then you're on literally the linear subspace that's in between. But given that the A's and the B's can be different for the different neurons, you could be at all kinds of different versions of linear subspaces between those two basis sets.
This would be a very delicate system, because to have an eigenvalue equal 1 means that you really cannot touch anything.
Absolutely true. That's one of the, I was sure that one of you was going to raise that. I'm not solving that problem here today, okay? I actually want your help to solve that problem. I know that there are people in the room who have thought a lot about how to make, you know, linear recurrent neural nets, transform them via nonlinearities into having stable attractor states. And basically, I'm hoping that those same tricks can be inserted here, Okay? So I'm not trying to solve that problem today. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, look, I mean, so it could be that you're going to stack this thing, right? So you could just plug the responses Y as inputs to the next brain area or next circuit, right? Or maybe you want to do an additional transformation on it, right? That in this case, as I'll show you, will enable you to get some time invariance, even though the activity is modulating over time. Okay? Or maybe it's us trying to read out the activity and reconstruct what the representation is, which is part of the game that I'm playing back at this slide. Here. Okay? The double step saccade. All right? So let me just describe to you the double step saccade task. It's similar to what we had before. You're holding fixation, but now instead of one target being flashed, there are two targets being flashed. You have to remember the locations of both of them. You have to make after a cue an eye movement to the first one while remembering the location of the second one. And then when you're cued again, you make an eye movement to the second one. Okay. Oftentimes, actually, the way these experiments are done, they're done without the additional delay period, but I'm going to insert the delay period. You could train an animal to do this. You could certainly train a person to do this. Okay. And what's hard about that is that after the first eye movement is made, the representation of the second target is now wrong, okay? Because the initial representation of the second target is here. So after I make the eye movement to the first target, now the fixation point has moved up from there to there, if I keep that same representation of the second target, I would move that way, which is wrong. Instead, I want to move that way. So the representation of that second target has to be updated at about the same time that the first eye movement is made. And that's a simple example of what I mean by manipulation in working memory. Okay?
And here you're assuming that you have retinotopic coordinates.
Yeah. Again, this is an oversimplified example. I'm literally coding X and Y coordinate of location on the screen. Okay? You know, I've implemented a version of this that does this all with more realistic neurons that have response fields for different locations on the screen, and you can do it that way as well. Yeah, it's relative to fixation. Retinotopic relative to fixation coordinates. But XY as opposed to, you know, a population of 100 neurons that have response fields that tile visual space, which is the way that we really think it's done. Okay? But I can show you that if you want. Okay, so now this is a complicated version of what I had before. At the top here, the top row, that's the location of target one. It comes on at this period of time. The blue is the x coordinate, so that's one. The red is the y coordinate, so that's a half. The second row is the location of target two, so that's at plus one minus a half. I'm also assuming that there's another input, which is the corollary discharge of the eye movement. And the corollary discharge of the eye movement comes from the readout of the location of the target just before the eye movement is made. So when you're making an eye movement to target one, you read out from here. When you're making an eye movement to target two, you read out from there. Okay? So I now have all of these inputs, the x and y coordinates of the two targets and the two sets of corollary discharge. So this is my input drive. Okay? This is going to be some kind of weighted sum of those guys. And this is some, you know, this is more rows in that embedding matrix that depends on those guys. These are my modulators, similar to what I had before. I turned them both on at the beginning, which is going to encode into the responses the input drive. And at the end, I turn on the A gate to shut everybody off. And during the eye movements, I have these little blips of turning B back on again, which integrates in the corollary discharge, okay, in the right way so as to update the target locations. These are my responses Y, and you can see that this is all set up so that you read out from here. What is the readout? The readout is those same two eigenvectors. Well, now there's four of them, two eigenvectors and two eigenvectors. The same, the eigenvectors of the recurrent weight matrix that correspond to eigenvalues equal to one. This gives me the readout of target location one before the first eye movement, target location two before the first eye movement. You integrate in the corollary discharge, This updates the representation. Now it's at 0, 0, because you've moved your eyes to that target. It updates this one. Now it's at 0, -1, which is now the correct runotopically centered location of target 2 after making the first eye movement. And then you do it again, and now this one's at 0, 0. Okay, and then you forget everything.
So yeah. For small b, the modulator is basically, b is basically how strong the input is.
Yeah.
So here you have a really strong input of 1.
At the beginning here, yeah.
And then suddenly the units are different because you only go to a third, so you're not reading in as much of the
yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that's something that's funny about the way that this is artificially set up, in which I have this one input embedding matrix that's handling two disparate sets of inputs, right? You might actually think of those as really being two separate encoding matrices with two separate sets of synapses and all of that. Sort of artificial. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I jiggered this all by hand so that this thing was on at the right amplitude for the right amount of time so that it integrates the right amount of stuff. Okay, but you know, you would really want to, if you were building an AI system, you'd want to learn all that, right? If you were building a brain, you would want to have a synaptic plasticity rule that would calibrate itself. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. So now comes the fun part. Okay, so at least for me, this was fun because, you know, unlike some of you, I actually, you know, before I started doing this work, I hadn't really given much thought to dynamical systems stuff for a while. So I discovered complex valued eigenvectors, eigenvalues. And the first thing I did was I said, okay, so what happens to this thing if you try and build a SynFire chain? And what's the simplest way to build a SynFire chain to get sequential activity? I took a recurrent weight matrix that was the identity, and I shifted it down one step off the diagonal, right? What does that mean? That means that, you know, neuron 1 has a strong excitatory input onto neuron 2, and neuron 2 has a strong excitatory input onto neuron 3, all the way down to neuron 100, as it turns out there's 100 of them here, which has a strong excitatory drive back onto neuron 1, okay? And I went and looked at the eigenvectors of that, and I started getting complex numbers, and I had to go look it up on Google. But you know, but I most of you in the room already know the answer, right? So this is an asymmetric recurrent weight matrix, so it's going to have complex valued eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And what we want now is we want the eigenvector, the largest eigenvalue, the real part of it, to be no bigger than 1, and then it's stable. And the imaginary parts of the eigenvalues determine the oscillation frequencies. Okay, so now I have oscillatory activity that looks kind of like a sequential activity. I have a better version of this now. I can show if you want MATLAB code. Yeah, exactly 1. Again, you know, subject to, we need to worry about how to fine tune it or how to make it more robust to not being fine-tuned, right? And I now have complex-valued responses, right? So how do you think about that? Well, the way that I think about that sort of naively is, you know, I actually have 2 neurons, right? One of which represents the real value of the response time course, another which represents the imaginary part of the response time course, and they're going to be tightly coupled with one another, okay? And so, like, this orange guy goes with that orange guy. You know, real part and imaginary part, they're actually quadrature phases of one another, as you'd expect, okay? So everything else is the same, and in fact, the readout is also the same subject to an unknown sign, okay? So if I compute the readout here as the same thing, these same eigenvectors times y and put an absolute value on it, then I'm going to get something that's constant over time in spite of the fact that the underlying neural activity is modulating over time. So I can read out something that's constant over time, even though the underlying neural activity looks like this sequential activity of one neuron handing off to the next, handing off to the next, handing off to the next. Yeah. Okay. Right. So this is a chain that goes all the way down and comes back to the beginning again. Is okay? Right. And so it ends up looking periodic here for that reason. Yeah. Now, in fact, interestingly, in Mike Halas's data, at least, the data that I flashed up near the beginning, they actually see that. So they see this sort of chain of activity that then repeats roughly every second in that particular experiment. What's that? Well, it's a traveling wave if it's arranged topographically. But this could be jumping around. I don't really know if these neurons here that are laid out in the order of my recurrent wave matrix are physically adjacent to one another in the brain. But it could be. Yeah. It could be. All right? But now we can go really crazy. So here I just made a recurrent wave matrix that I designed to have 10 eigenvectors that have 10 eigenvalues that have real parts equal to 1. The other 90 are less than 1. And random imaginary parts to those eigenvalues, okay, that are all relatively small values so that the oscillation frequencies are low so that I can make a pretty looking graph. And this is the same kind of thing I was showing you before. There's some input. You turn the gates on. It latches in the input. You turn the A and the B gates off and let the dynamics play out, and you get these complicated dynamics, right? But I can still read it. This one happens to have a dimensionality of 10 because I picked 10 of the eigenvalues to have real parts equal to 0. I just did it that way. I could have made it 98, I could have made it 13, whatever you want. Right? So this is a 10-dimensional continuous attractor. And it plays out this interesting dynamics. The dynamics depend on what? The basis functions are the eigenvectors, which, you know, each have an oscillation frequency that depends on the imaginary part of the corresponding eigenvalues, right? I know what it is, right? But with 10 of them, or with 98 of them, I basically am getting all kinds of complicated dynamics as sums of sinusoids and cosinusoids, right? So here it's just fixed, right? All I did here was the same thing I was doing earlier, which is switch the state by making the A and B gate go to 0 and just allowing the dynamics to play out.
Can you say again why you have this?
Because the imaginary parts of the this is the recurrent weight matrix, real part and imaginary part. The corresponding eigenvalues have imaginary parts that are non-zero. So each eigenvector is now associated with an oscillation frequency that's, you know, 2 pi times the imaginary part of the eigenvalue or something like that, divided by 1,000 to turn it into milliseconds.
You're not perturbing
anything. I'm just letting it play out, right? So this reminds me a lot of, you know, what we heard about from Byron the other day and from David, you know, about kind of the intrinsic dynamics kind of autonomously playing out, right? You set a state with A and B large so that it's input driven. You're kind of latching in an input, and then you change the state and say go. And you get all kinds of complicated dynamics. But even though the dynamics are complicated, I know how to read it out. At any instant in time, I can multiply by the same readout matrix, which is just made up of the eigenvectors corresponding to the eigenvalues that have real parts equal to 1, and take the absolute value of that, and I'll get something that's constant over time. So I can pull out a constancy in spite of the change in dynamics if I want to. If my goal is to, you know, do short-term memory, I can do that in spite of the short-term dynamics, okay? But you can also do other fun things to it, right? The oscillations here, these sinusoids and cosinusoids, you can think of as basis functions for the dynamics of movements, complicated movements that are made up of, you know, a whole Fourier series of components. Yeah. That's if I'm thinking about working memory. If I'm thinking about, well, let's get, I'll show you, you know, I already just kind of did a teaser preview of it, so I can sort of jump ahead to it. We'll come back to this in a second. So I was thinking about this stuff last winter, and I got the flu, and so I ended up watching a lot of the Olympics. And I saw this, so we have to cite Sean White for the backside double McTwist. And you know, this is like an amazing motor act, right? He like goes up the side of the wall of the, you know, of the half pipe, and then there's this mostly ballistic sequence of movements that then occurs. And he maybe has a split second to spot the landing, but basically it's ballistic. And it's a whole sequence of movements that has to unfold with some complicated dynamics over time, or he hits the side of the thing and breaks his head, which he did do once, but not during the Olympics this year, right? And so the idea is what I was just saying. Instead of thinking of this now as short-term memory, think of it as motor preparation. You latch in an initial state by turning A and B on, then you flip A and B both off and out plays a bunch of dynamics. This is the dynamics that you get, real part, imaginary part, if the input drives only the first eigenvector, and of course you're going to get sinusoids that all have the same oscillation frequency but different amplitudes and phases, right? This is what you get with from the, if you, the input hits only the second eigenvector, and this is what you get if you drive both of them, right? But if I have, you know, 30, 40, 98 degrees of freedom of the eigenvectors to choose from here, then I can actually, you know, I could do, you know, a double backside McTwist 1260. I just need to have the right recurrent weight matrix. And the right timing about when to switch the gates off, right? And then the dynamics unfolds, okay? Which is why I asked David yesterday, you know, you why not think of your decoding neural network as literally the computation that the neurons are doing? And why not think of, instead of having a separate, you know, set of what did you call them, factors, just choose, pull the eigenvectors out of the GRU, out of the recurrent weight matrix of the GRU, and use that as your factors. They're already there, or they should already be there. And then what you're doing, instead of just a tool, it's actually, you know, a tool for simplifying data. It's a model, and you're using PyTorch, or I guess you don't use, you're using whatever you use at Google, you know, as a means for data fitting. TensorFlow as a means for data fitting, right? Instead of just as a means for generating it.
I think that for me, I'm thinking about the sort of state space dynamics as the meaningful sort of abstract, if you will, oxymoronish abstract mechanism to think about comparing between neural data and what these trainable dynamic systems are.
Yeah. Yeah, presumably you need some slow ones and some fast ones, yeah. Yeah, you would need to have some slow ones and some fast ones, for sure. Yeah. So that...
You could make some faster ones at the right time. You could make a slow one out of some nonlinear output gating.
You could, potentially, but you know, the slow ones will come about from having weak synaptic weights in the recurrence, right? You want those imaginary parts to be have small values, right? Yeah, that would be a different mechanism for getting it, but yeah. I'm going to get to that in the next slide. There's a different way to get an overall control over timing, stretching and squashing time, but yeah.
I don't remember the details now, but Mark Goldman had some suggestion of similar to this, kind of reading out from various neurons that have some dynamics, like finding a chain inside it.
I don't know the paper, but help me find it.
He's talking about non-normal dynamics, non-normal matrices. Then you have essentially a feed-forward chain embedded within a recurrent network.
So then this is kind of fun. So here's one generalization of it, which is that I'm just going to now allow for a moment the time constant, the intrinsic time constant, to have a subscript j on it. Okay, So now the different neurons can have different time constants. In particular, what I'm thinking, of course, is a difference in the time constant for excitatory inhibitory subclasses of neurons. So it's not every J that'll have a different one, but there will be subgroups of them. And, you know, so it's straightforward enough to derive a constraint on when the thing is going to be stable, right? So, you know, so now it's this thing. The stability depends on the eigenvalues of this thing. Those eigenvalues in this case have to be less than zero the way that it's written, which now has, this is a diagonal matrix of 1 over the taus, okay? And when that's true, you'll either get sustained delay period activity or you'll get sustained stable oscillations. And if that's not true, then you'll get things that like decay like this. And then you can also play games if you just scale all of those time constants by the same scale factor, then you'll stretch time. Okay, so this is related to a paper of Chaim Sampolinsky's a number of years ago of using a shunting-like control of time scale, right? But if you shunt, you change not only the gain but also the time constant. Oh, okay, it's your paper. Okay, great paper. Anyway, this idea is stolen from you. I should be citing it. Okay, so I promised this, so I'll do it. Let me just step back for a second. So when I put this thing up, right? So there's a particular form for this here, right? So to the plus sign, by the way, I didn't say means a rectifying nonlinearity, half-wave rectification, for example. So the b over 1 plus b and the 1 over 1 plus a, seems a little bit arbitrary, right? You could, you know, before I was doing this a lambda and 1 minus lambda, right? I don't really like that because then, you know, you have to worry about whether the lambda is less than 1 as well as being bigger than 0. So, you know, so I kind of like this form better for that reason, that it's just rectified, okay? It can be any number bigger than 0. That is easy to imagine how neurons do rectification. It's a little bit harder to imagine how they give you a sharp saturation. But really where this came from was fiddling around one Saturday morning with an electrical circuit model very simplified electrical circuit model of a pyramidal cell in which the A refers to the apical dendrites and the B refers to the basal dendrites. So this is what I did. So this by the way, and there was a beautiful art show at NYU this past year of some of Cajal's original drawings, and this is a photo with my cell phone of that. So if you've never seen them in person and you have an opportunity to do so, do so. The just seeing them in person is way better than seeing the reproductions. So simple equivalent circuit model of a pyramidal cell in which I have three compartments that are connected with resistors, RC circuit in each one, with variable conductance resistors for shunting synapses, and I'm just modeling other synapses as current injections. So basal dendrite, soma, apical dendrite. You write out the math, you get an expression of this form, and at steady state, you end up with something of this form in which the membrane potential looks like 1 over 1 plus stuff times the current injected here, and there's a 1 over 1 plus stuff times the current injected in the apical dendrites, and if you just substitute in the A for this, the B for that, the input drive for these two things, and the recurrent drive for that thing, you get exactly what we want. Oh, then I got it backwards. Just switch A and B. It's symmetric. I don't care. I thought this was right. I thought the inputs went into the basal and the recurrence went into the apical. Do I have that wrong? Okay, fine.
So the
then I'll fix it. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So the A's and the B's have to come from somewhere. And again, so this is a stretch, but I'm leaning on this paper from Halas's lab and another one from Carol Svoboda's lab. This was in prefrontal cortex. This was in motor cortex. That there are thalamocortical loops that modulate recurrent activity in cortex. Okay. So so the idea is the A's and B's come from somewhere, and one possibility is that the A's and B's are computed, one or the other or both of them, in the thalamus via recurrent loop, and then they come back up and provide essentially a shunting input onto either the apical or basal dendrites. Now, it might be that one of them is done in a local circuit and one of them is done in a long-term thalamocortical circuit, and I think that's why Bijan had his hand up, because you might think, yeah, okay. Why would you think that, Bijan? Okay, right. Okay, yep. So it would be very cool, so where we're at now is kind of taking this theoretical framework and throwing out hypotheses, right? I think it's a source of hypothesis generation. So wouldn't it be cool if the A gate was computed in a local circuit that had really fast dynamics and the B gate was computed via a thalamocortical loop that had more sluggish dynamics, right? That's something that should be testable, right? So the kind of experiment that Halassa did and that Svoboda did to determine that there's a thalamocortical loop that's relevant, right, didn't separate out these two components, the input drive versus the recurrent drive, but one could, now thinking about it in this way. Okay. Wow, I'm getting through many more slides than I expected to. Okay, so how about sensory processing? Well, we all know what deep nets are. They have an architecture that looks like this. It's a feed-forward, weighted sum, and then an output nonlinearity of some kind, rectifying output nonlinearity. So you can, the thing I've described to you is a generalization of that, right? It looks instead like this. If we make the encoding matrix be convolutional, right, then we're doing the same thing. If I have a rectifying output nonlinear on the y's, then the recurrence, right, just sits in right here. And I could in fact stack them the same way that you stack a deep net. And if I set A and B large, then it behaves exactly like a deep net because it's all input driven. And this feedback loop is irrelevant. If there's time, I'll show you what I think is a much cooler way to stack them rather than just doing it in this sort of feed-forward cascade of providing the outputs of one as the input to the next one. But you can do everything that you can do with a deep net, you could do by stacking these devices. And you could also have some, working memory for free along the way. But I want to lay out what I think is a particularly interesting way of making use of this. And that has to do with prediction. So this is what we had before down here. That is the dynamical system I showed you before. Okay? And one can derive that from an optimization criterion. So you can think of this as being like the analog of a Hamiltonian, and this as being the analog of the equations of motion. Okay, so we're going to optimize this by doing gradient descent on it, and you end up with that. So what is this? This says I have some energy-like thing. It's not real energy. It's just some stuff that I want to minimize. And what I want to do is I want to make the output look like the input drive. Remember, the input drive is a weighted sum of the input. Okay. So that means, so if you think of this is like sensory cortex, then the embedding matrix is the receptive field. So I want to make the output look like what the receptive fields want the output to be, weighted by this modulator. I also want the output to look something like the recurrent drive, okay, where that's an alpha, not an A, okay. We can call this lambda and that 1 minus lambda, right? So that's my time constant. And this is my recurrent gain. So alpha controls my recurrent gain in this world, and B separately controls the time constant, okay? Take the derivative of that, simplify, do a little change of variables where now this is an A and that's an alpha, okay, and we have the same form that we had before, right? So in this form, the A and the B together both control the time constant and the recurrent gain. In this form, it's a little bit more cleanly separated, but you now have, you know, the control knobs don't feel right, okay? In this form, you have one control knob for the basal dendrites and another control knob for the apical dendrites, okay? All right. So let's just play a little game with this. Let's change this a little bit. Let's make a variation on this, okay? And the variation looks like this. I'm now going to have a bunch of Ys, and I'm going to design them so that they have different oscillation frequencies. I'm basically doing a Fourier analysis, okay? I'm going to have a bunch of neurons that all have different intrinsic oscillation frequencies, and I want to make the sum of their responses, the real parts of their responses, be close to the input. I'm just getting rid of the extra embedding matrix here to make it simpler, okay? And I want them to be close to the recurrent drive. And well, what's the recurrent drive? The recurrent drive is whatever their oscillation frequency says they should be an instant later, okay? And I want to optimize this thing, okay? So I basically want to take my input and decompose it into a sum of basis functions, which are all oscillators, right? Sines and cosines of different frequencies. And the oscillators are going to, like, push each other along over time, okay? So you take the derivative of this thing in the same way, take the gradient of that thing, and that's going to determine my dynamics, my equations of motion, play the same little trick here. And I have end up with something that looks like this. That's exactly what I had before. I now have this extra term, right, which looks like, you know, so it has this modulator, and it also has in it a difference between the response of each neuron. Remember, now the J's are for these different frequencies in my Fourier series, and the sum of the rest of them. I think that should be K not equal to J, if I've got this right. Or maybe it's the sum of all of them. It's a kind of predictive coding constraint, right? This term looks like, you know, you have to add some stuff in, which is the stuff that's not well predicted by the other neurons in the group, so that they end up competing with one another a little bit to explain the input. So that's what it looks like. So basically, I'm taking basis functions, which are sinusoids and cosinusoids, and using them to fit an input. So if I provide an input from past time up to time zero and run that dynamical system, okay, with the A and B gate on, okay, then this is what the real part of the responses looks like. That's what the imaginary part of the responses look like. The blue curve is the sum of the real parts. The red curve is the sum of the imaginary parts. The blue curve follows the input. The red curve is the Hilbert transform of that, the quadrature pair of that. But then at time equals zero, I switch the gates to be both equal to zero, okay? Because there's no more input. But the responses continue to play out in time, okay? So it's just kind of running itself forward in time based on this set of sinusoid and cosinusoid basis functions that were fit to pass time. Does that make sense? Okay, did you have a question? So why is this important? Well, because prediction is important, right? When Serena goes to hit a ball, when she's not fighting with the referee, she actually makes the decision about where to take the swing when the ball is way back here, so that the racket is in the right place for some time point in the future, right? If you're not doing predictive processing, then you're always going to be behind, and no one would be able to play tennis, and everybody in Manhattan would be hit by a bus. Okay, it's more than that, though. This was mentioned in XJ's talk a number of years ago with a guy named Ori Hassan at Princeton. We did a series of fMRI experiments having to do with prediction and timescales of processing, which we had people watch movies in an MRI scanner, forward, backward, and scrambled, okay? So what you're gonna see here is the backward movie, okay? It's a Charlie Chaplin movie, and I want you to try and figure out what's going on. Okay. Now I'm going to show. Now I'm going to show you the forward movie, and you can see how well you did at interpreting the backward movie. So this is the forward movie. Okay, so now most people actually blow it. How many of you got the right interpretation of the backward movie? How many of you got the wrong interpretation of the backward movie? Right, okay. So the sequence of events matters, and the argument is, you know, this is not really tight science here, but the inference is that when you're watching a movie, when you're interacting with the real world, your brain is constantly making a prediction about what's going to happen next and is comparing that prediction with what unfolds. And so when you're watching the backward movie, it's almost like a visual illusion, like a bistable visual illusion. You're constantly trying to change the interpretation. I should have mentioned Nava Rubin, who's here this week, also did this fMRI paper with Ori and I. And one of the things we learned from that study, from that fMRI study, is that there are different timescales of processing, which we interpreted as different timescales of prediction in different brain areas. So in early sensory brain areas, the accumulation of information is over short timescales, and presumably the prediction forward in time is over short timescales. And in other brain areas, the timescale is much longer, so tens of seconds. And so the idea here is that in order to do prediction, of course, you need a model, like, you know, where's the hurricane going to hit? And the thinking is that the synaptic, you know, weights in the deep net-like neural network is the model. That's your model of the world, okay? And that what goes along with having kind of more complex abstract representations from one brain area to the next is having longer and longer timescales of prediction, okay? And there's a particular, so I can't build an artificial neural network without at least the full power of Google to predict the Charlie Chaplin movie, but I can play around with simple things like this, okay? So a simple moving stimulus, right? And the thought is, you know, so on a short spatial and temporal scale, this is pretty complicated looking, right? But at a more abstract representation, it's actually really simple. It's just a thing that is constantly oscillating, right? So this is a space-time representation of the input stimulus. It goes right, then it goes left, then it goes right. That's space, that's time. We'd like to be able to predict it forward in time. We're gonna base that on the kind of standard feed-forward visual motion architecture that's been around for decades, in which we feed the stimulus into space-time-oriented receptive fields and compute motion energy. And once you do that, this thing that has a pretty complicated high-frequency structure to it over time becomes something that turns into a very low-frequency structure to it over time. Right, and the point here is to just match this intuition that that different stages of processing as you move further and further from the sensory periphery are representing information in a more abstract way, more abstracted from the pixels in the stimulus or the photoreceptor responses in the retina, but also more abstract in terms of time, longer, slower timescales. Okay. All right, so let's do that. So let's take the time series prediction thing that I talked about before, and now we're going to stuff it into a three-layer network. Okay, three whole layers. That's as deep as I get. Okay, but I'm going to simplify it a little bit also. So I turned the A's and B's back into lambdas and 1 minus lambdas, and I'm going to add in a moment another state parameter, alpha, which is just the overall gain for the different layers. So now I have this superscript I, which is layer, and I have three layers. I have my lambdas, my 1 minus lambdas. Everything else is pretty much the same as it was before, except I now have responses of neurons that are different frequencies, different intrinsic oscillation frequencies, that's the M. And then there's also different channels for, say, like rightward motion and leftward motion selective, Okay? I'm going to use I'm just going to use the motion energy architecture that I already mentioned. And this is my optimization criterion. So what do we have here? We want the responses to look like the input drive at each layer, okay? That is the sum of the responses to look like the input drive. What is the input drive? The input drive is the square of a convolution, okay? So this convolution squaring motion energy, okay? And I also want the responses to look like the prediction of the prior from the previous time steps. This is basically the same thing we had before, which is determined by the intrinsic oscillation frequency, which I'm indexing by M, okay? And this is just these sines and cosines. Okay, so take the derivatives of that, right? Do gradient descent on that, and you get terms that look familiar. This is the feed-forward drive, that is, make the input look like the input drive. Make the responses look like the input drive. In this case, the sum of them across the basis functions for different oscillation. This is make the responses look like the prior, or the recurrent drive from the previous time step. And lo and behold, this magical thing happens, which is as soon as you stack these things in this way, you know, according to this optimization, you also get another term here that drops out, which is a feedback drive. And this one says, so look, this has an I plus one. So basically, this one says, if I'm in layer I, and I'm providing input to somebody in layer I plus one, and I'm trying to say your response should be bigger, right? Then he's going to say back to me, no, actually, the input drive that you're providing to me should be smaller. And there's a little negotiation that's happening there. Okay, and that drops out, of course, because there's a term here when you're at layer I plus 1 that has an I plus 1 right here, that has an I plus 1 there, that has an I right there. So when I take the derivative with respect to Y superscript I, that's going to depend on the Z's at layer I plus 1. Okay, so just chain rule. Right? So that's kind of cool, because now there's a role for feedback here in negotiating what the responses are across these different layers, which is very different from the way of stacking it that I mentioned earlier, which is just providing the outputs of one as the inputs to another. Here, there's actually a whole recurrence across the different layers in addition to across time. And that's what's kind of illustrated here. The basic kind of core computation is weighted sum of the inputs gives you the input drive. There's also this feedback from the next layer that depends on the transpose of the same of the weight matrix. There's also this thing happening here over time, and then the output goes back to the previous layer. Okay, and you throw all that stuff together, and you can get this thing to work. So you provide the oscillating grating as an input. I'm pre-processing that with a biphasic temporal impulse. This is my model of the retina. Sorry, that's all I've got. And this is the output of layer one. This is the real part, that's the imaginary part. The imaginary part comes along for free through these complex valued basis functions, right? The sines and cosines that, you know, the sine phase guys are there. This is my spatial weights for the motion energy. This is layer three, just showing, you know, essentially constant, very low frequent, right? So it starts off as this high frequency thing. Once you get up to layer three, it's been demodulated. This is like demodulating a demodulated signal. Okay, to get something that's constant over time and consequently easily predictable, right? And because this is so simple, it feeds back and constrains this to reach the global minimum of the optimization as a whole. Yeah.
The motion energy is going left and right, right?
Yeah.
Whereas that doesn't show up in layer three, or you're saying that that's the motion energy of the motion energy.
That's the motion. The layer three is the motion energy of the motion energy. This is the motion energy is in layer two.
So in layer two, there's like going right, going left.
Yeah, that's what I showed earlier. Yeah, that's what was on this slide, right? And then the demodulated motion energy is constant over time. That's exactly the point of layer three. Okay. Now the other thing that's kind of cool about this is that, you know, in a way, this is kind of a mess. But it's also kind of a feature. This is a non-convex optimization, right? So this thing can exhibit multiple local minima, which means that, you know, referring to Nava's talk earlier in the week, with some noise added, you can bounce back and forth between different interpretations, okay? And whenever there's going to be incompatibilities in representation. Okay, all of that stuff, all of this stuff, because I went through it pretty fast, that's published in the PNAS paper last year. All of the other stuff before that that didn't have more than one layer, that's in the archive paper that was posted online. So where are we? You know, I'm not fitting data here, right? I'm not looking at specific experiments yet. It's more of a kind of conceptual framework of, you know, as it turns out, drawing from the AI literature, these ideas from these silly named LSTMs of having a gated integration and reset, and the two modulators that I'm talking about, that both control the effective time constant and the recurrent gain is one way to think about it, or turning on and off sensory integrators, another way to think about it. There's a very specific concrete notion here of dimensionality, right? And it's just the number of eigenvectors that are equal, that have eigenvalues that have real parts that are equal to one or that are near one in the recurrent weight matrix, right? And there's a very specific notion here of the manifold in which the neural activity dynamics unfolds, which is given by that linear subspace, okay? Constraints on the stability, this time warping idea, and what, you know, what I find interesting about it is that with this computational, slight variations on this computational motif, you can think about a bunch of different tasks or systems, tasks that the brain needs to perform, or systems in which that computation has to play out, right? And sensory processing and motor preparation, in executive control, like working memory, in prediction, and in this inference, in the multi-scale, multi-layer network. The other thing I didn't say and should have said is that back here, when you look at this thing with the multiple layers, you can set these state parameters, the alphas and the lambdas, into one state in which it's going to behave just like a deep net. It'll be entirely feed-forward driven, right? So you make lambda be big, and you make the alpha at the bottom layers be big, and at the higher layers be lower, and it'll just behave like a feed-forward thing. Or you can flip those state parameters and make behave entirely like a generative model. You seed it with some, you know, output, desired output, and it'll produce an input that is consistent according to whatever the weights are in all of the connections between layers. It'll produce an input that's consistent with that output. Or you can set it to some intermediate state, which is analogous to, and in some cases approximates, Bayesian inference, in which you think of the thing that you're seeding at the top as being a prior, as the stimulus at the bottom, that's the likelihood, and it negotiates a middle ground between them. And again, that's in the published PNAS paper. That's what I mean by inference in a multilayer current network. I think there's lots of stuff that you can do with this, both in neuroscience and in AI. And funding none. Lots of people have talked to me about this. Wayne Mackey is a very talented postdoc in my lab. And I actually finished on time, didn't I? All right. Thank you very much. Yeah, Alessandro.
Great talk. I'm enjoying it very, very much. I'm a bit bothered by these cosines, but maybe I understand, tell me if I'm wrong, that the way to get out of the reason of the cosines is to play with the A and B, so the alpha and lambda, to have them interact more profoundly than just resetting them.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so first of all, so one of the ideas here is that, you know, it's so the linear dynamical systems mathematics gives you oscillators really easily, right? So how can I get complex dynamics out of oscillators? Well, have a bunch of them with different frequencies, and then I'm basically decomposing it in a Fourier series, and I can do anything I want, okay? And that's kind of the world of signal processing that I come from that I'm comfortable with, right? So that's one answer. The other answer is that I haven't, in what I showed you, I haven't even remotely tapped into the power of the computation here, right? Which, you know, which is absorbed into a whole bunch of the AI applications of GRUs and LSTMs, which is that the A's and the B's are actually dynamically changing. Well, they don't use A and B. The input gate and the reset gate are dynamically changing based on the current inputs and the current outputs, the current state. Okay? And then you can get all kinds of crazy stuff to happen, right? I don't know how to analyze that. I do almost know how to analyze it during these phases of time when the modulators are constant, because then I've got a linear system. It's easiest if, you know, A and B are both full on, then it's input driven, or full off, then it's recurrent driven. That's particularly easy. It's particularly easy when the A and the B is the same for every principal neuron across all the different J's, right? But it still seems like it's possible to get into an intuition for it if the A's and B's are different from one another for different neurons, as long as they're constant for a long enough period of time that the eigenvalues that are less than one or way less than one decay away. Okay, then it's projecting onto some combination of the projection rows of the encoding matrix and the eigenvectors of the recurrent weight matrix, right? That's the way to think about it, right? So that in that kind of domain in which the modulators aren't changing too rapidly, then I think we can understand it. Yeah, David.
So a couple of observations from the deployment of these gated systems in the machine learning framework. What you see is actually that the gates are changing all the time, and that if you want to go hunting for There's an analogous version in interpretability of deep learning of like what neuroscientists used to do is find a single neuron that represents some particular value for a few time steps and say, oh look, that particular cell is representing this value for a few time steps. But actually, those gates are really complicated, and finding the right interpretation for them is highly non-trivial. So because one can just turn it around and say this is easily.
So I'm not sure that the AI applications have actually tackled this in a way to simplify things as much as possible. So two things that I would do if I had a team of people working on this stuff with me at Google. One is that I would go with complex weights, because then you get lots of dynamics out of it for free. With the gates fixed, you can still get complex dynamics by having sums of oscillators. The other thing I would do is consider doing away with having fully general weight matrices, basically learn a lesson from convolutional neural nets and go with simpler, maybe even convolutional weight matrices, but have more of them, right? So you could think of there as being a sum, a series of modulator times convolutional recurrent weight matrix plus another modulator separate times another convolutional weight matrix in order to reduce the dimensionality of the parameters that need to be estimated, right? And it might be possible to get close to the same computational power or even more by doing those kinds of things, and then you're also going to be able to stack it up over more layers, right?
Mm-hmm. Found. And so one view of what these systems are doing is actually they're just helping with the training, and that sort of the maintenance of any individual piece of memory for some very long term is still pretty much a wide open problem, or is considered to be so.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it remains to be seen. I think what's been done with them so far has been limited by what's learnable, and that's been problematic because if you allow the weight matrices to be fully general, you know, if this is like, how big would it be? 30 by 30? 100 by 100? Yeah, in a practical application. A dozen by a dozen? 5,000 by 5,000 plus, there's another one here that's 5,000 by 5,000 plus, another one here, another one here, another one here, another one here. That's a huge parameter space, which makes it then impossible to stack them 20 layers deep. And in fact, you know, as far as I know, with recurrent neural nets and LSTMs and the AI literature, like three is as deep as it gets. No, you guys are past that now? Okay, and they're fully general 1,000 by 1,000 weight matrices at every step of the way. Okay, so I will posit, with no proof, that by imposing more structure on it, analogous to a ConvNet, you could actually end up doing much better. Right? So that's part of the game plan here is that, so by the way, so what's the difference between what I've done here and a GRU? Two fundamental things. I have complex valued responses and weights. There is a small literature using complex valued weights with LSTMs for different reasons, but I'm doing it to get dynamics. The second thing is by rescaling the recurrent weight matrix so that the largest eigenvalue has an eigenvalue equal to real part equal to one, I can get rid of the LSTMs all have a tan H on the output neurons. So to specifically avoid things blowing up if the recurrent weight matrix has bigger eigenvalues, right? Which is kind of problematic when you're trying to do gradient descent because you're basically flat out there. I'm also replacing a sigmoid on the gates with this other version of a sigmoid, but that's less important. And I would argue that, you know, those things might be helpful in taking it a step further, you know, to add structure to the weight matrices and reduce the number of parameters could in the long run, then by adding more of those weight matrices and more layers, give you as much as more power. This is analogous to the success of ConvNets, right? Go from general weight matrices to convolutional weight matrices with deep nets and replace the complicated output nonlinearities with half-wave rectification. And that's what basically powered, starting in 2012, all the successes that have been reported with deep nets. Yeah, David.
Should be important another step, demand zero. But to take this and actually use your idea about the compartments of the parameter set and actually implement it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think it's possible to do it with all the constraints that you have just said about the eigenvalues that should be one and how to deal with it? Or there are some steps that should be done before we go to this implementation?
Yeah, so I think there's some more steps that I would do before going to a spiking model. I mean, the kind of next steps that I'm most interested in are taking this computational motif and applying it to a bunch of different behavioral tasks that animals are trained on, and you know, basically demonstrating this actually really is capable of doing those tasks. I'm very interested in working on the learning rules that would be potentially biologically plausible for learning what the weights are. So back propagation through time, I'm thinking, is not a biologically plausible learning rule. I think something based on prediction and prediction error might be, which in the AI literature, for those of you who know it, it's probably close to something that they call target propagation instead of back propagation. Hit a target value rather than hit a value that, you know, was left over from 10 seconds ago or 10 characters ago. So I'm interested in those things. You know, there are data sets around, like the stuff from Ruse-Bey's lab that Elad was talking about, in which they have neural recordings from populations of neurons while animals perform tasks that have multiple phases in the task, right? In which you kind of imagine that these modulators or gates are turning on and off, you know, so simultaneously fitting the behavior and the neural data. You know, those are all things that I would do first before going too far down the rabbit hole of getting the mechanisms completely sorted out. And there's this big open question here that I've danced around of how to ensure that the fine tuning that's needed here is finessed, right? I can sort of imagine some ways that I would think about doing that, but I think there's some collective expertise already on how to tackle that problem, just, you know, thinking about linear neural integrators and how to make them robust with respect to fine-tuning that I'm hoping can just be absorbed into this, because all I've really done is taken that and add these modulators to it. Great.